The Off the Ball Podcast Network. Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Dan McDonald in studio, the opening weekend of the League of Ireland. Dan, hello.
Hi, Joe.
Richie McCormick, hello to you.
Hello, Joe.
53106 is the text number. We are at Off the Ball on Twitter. How was the opening weekend, Dan?
It was 5-1-0 wins, Joe.
Thrilling, I would
1-0
say.
1-0 to the insert favourite club name here.
Storm Dennis was the big winner.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, the weather wasn't much of an excuse on Friday, I don't think, really, for the game. Certainly, I was at the Dock Derry. It was actually a decent game. The second half was the decent level anyway. Yeah, Saturday, Bowes Rovers, the highlight of the weekend, was a bit of a non-event, really. You know, last-minute drama, and brilliant for Rovers, and they enjoyed the celebrations, but I suppose as someone just going to it sort of, you know, neutrally to report it and hopefully, you know, reporting an event, the whole thing just didn't really work out, you know. I mean, the TV coverage being lost because of the wind. I pretty much left the house thinking it wasn't going to go ahead, expecting, you know, at any minute to just be turning back almost. Yeah. And then suddenly realised they were going ahead with the game. And I mean, the conditions during the match were fine. I can guess, I can see why it did, but just, I don't know, just a bit flat, really. You know, as an opening weekend, like, they've got a balls of it, really. You know what I mean?
Moving the game.
Yeah, well, I mean,
it didn't need to be moved.
So there's a fixture computer, of course, that does the fixtures, but obviously, you know, there's always planning that goes around these things. Like, they've done things this year, they've quite sensibly, I would say. For example, the four teams that are in Europe, they've made sure that they're playing each other on the same weekend so they can move one round forward from July to the summer. I've been saying they should have for a couple of years. So it's sensible. That's, you know, fair play to them. That's something that's been done. It shows that obviously there's always an element of planning. There's a reason why very rarely you see two title chasers playing each other in the last game of the season. You know, the opening weekend, there's always a thinking behind it. Have a good game. And for some reason this time round, they decided to go for Bowes Rovers, even though I know that Bowes did not want that as an opening game. They had changed security firms. They wanted a bit of a lead into the opening match, you know. And Rovers up first was going to be a bit of a test. Also, as well, there was instances with the Cup semi-final last year, which meant that Bowes basically knew that whenever they played Rovers on a Friday, the local Gardaí had indicated it was going to be moved away from Friday to a Saturday. But it appears that the fixture list went out without maybe thinking through some of these things. So the big announcement when the fixture list was released was Bowes will play Shamrock Rovers on the opening day of the season, Friday at 7:45 p.m. And then, of course, you know, that was before clearly going to the guards who said, well, that game's not taking place on Friday. We need to have this game on Saturday. So then it was moved because of that. And then you had, like, the weather. That's just unfortunate. You can't account for that. But then, you know, the weather meant that the game couldn't be shown. So you have the opening weekend. You've lost your highlight. It's been moved from its natural date. Bowes Rovers will sell out at any time of the season. It doesn't need to be the opening game. And if anything, the big build-up into it probably just heightened some of the, I don't know, heightened some of the scrutiny and attention on it. So it just could have been handled a lot better from a number of elements. Some bad luck. As I said, I wrote a piece today, some bad luck, some bad planning. And that's basically it, you know, the weather really, really punished some decisions that probably shouldn't be made in the first place. And of course, there's headlines and there's you know, images of you know, post-match sort of fights, basically, you know, amongst the idiot fans. You don't even know if they're all even at the game. And, you know, clearly there is a security. The logic would be that if you have the game on a Saturday or in a daytime, it's better than an evening time because, you know, the natural inclination you would think is, well, it's resources, but also people getting boozed up throughout the day and whatnot. But really, that didn't really work because they met at the centrepiece of a Saturday afternoon. And
stupid, you know, people are going to be stupid people no matter what day it is and no matter what time of day it is.
Unfortunately, that's true. You know, that I think if that game was at 10 o'clock in the morning, people who want to have cause aggro will find a way to cause aggro. And it's generally outside the ground, not in the ground itself. So I would question the need to have moved the game in the first place. But I accept that Bowes knew there was a few instances at the semi-final last year. They were on their last warning. And then some things happened at that game. They knew that was going to be moved. But why it had to be the first game of the season, I just don't understand it.
Okay.
I don't understand it. So that's just a bit of a low because, I mean, you want to have, like, it's actually a good weekend to launch the league. It's a Six Nations game. There's been the Premier League winter break, so it's, you know, it's not that active. So it's actually probably a quiet sporting weekend. So it's actually a great platform, you know, to announce yourself and to arrive. And again, I'll go back, it wasn't handled very well, but I do think people, I mean, this would have been predated new sort of people coming into the FAI, and I think they're aware. You know, I think the lessons probably will be learned from it. So I'm not going to bang on about it too much. Sure. You know, but I think in future, obviously, having that game in the first weekend is just a complete no-no.
So the images of the fighting outside the stadium popped up on my phone, certainly on Twitter, across Saturday afternoon. And it looked like a bunch of idiots who had watched a bad Danny Dyer film and thought they wanted to pretend they were part of the English 1980s hooliganism scene.
Yeah.
Pretty embarrassing, actually. So it looked like 30 people tops. Is this a routine thing?
Richie would know as well. I mean, yeah, like around Bowes Rovers games, this does happen. You know, there have been games in the last year where nothing has, in recent years, nothing has happened. You know, but there are times where it does happen. And I do have a certain sympathy with, say, the Gardaí or whatever, because I mean, I was down there early on Saturday and I bumped, you know, I was chatting to a couple of guards who were just walking down laneways and whatever. Like, you know, they don't know where it's generally not really, as I said, in the ground itself. You might, in the ground itself, you'd have someone, you know, hopping to pitch and trying to cause. But like, that's just, I don't want to be too po-faced about that, because like, this is just an atmosphere. It's passion. There's games. Sometimes it's going to spill over. People are going to be a bit like, it's probably is an aggressive environment. It's not for everyone. But like, that's, to a degree, as much as it is normal.
But it's around
the stadium and those things where people on the street are going about their business. That's deplorable, you know, and that's...
I've seen stuff happen. Like, it's not just... It doesn't happen in the stadium.
You're a Bowes fan, we should say.
Yeah, it doesn't happen in the stadium per se. I've seen things amongst idiots kicking off as far away as heading towards O'Connell Street. People who've filtered... I remember Saturday afternoon match... People are filtering away down towards back towards town, and it basically kicking off around there. But it doesn't happen usually within the ground. There'll be a bit of an atmosphere. There'll be a bit of an edge within the ground. Within the ground's fine. And again, it's not just confined to Irish games. To think that this has been swept under the carpet in England and elsewhere is a complete lie. This kind of level of stuff, to the level that we saw of those pictures and videos and stuff doing the rounds on Saturday, that happens pretty much every English league ground. It's not right. It shouldn't happen.
No.
But it's not an Irish thing, and it's not a Dublin Derby thing. It happens.
It's at odds with our sporting culture.
It is, very much so.
But like, at the same time, I think it portrays the image sometime of this Bowes Rovers game. It's like Beirut or something in there. You know, like it's crazy. It's chaos. It's not actually. You know what I mean? There's tensions. You know, it's certainly, you know, if your sensitivities are offended by, you know, language and chanting and certain things, then it mightn't be for you. But it's really, like, as I said, you know,
but sorry,
clearly arranged to a degree between people.
You used the line deplorable, which it was, because the footage I saw was somebody sitting in traffic, and what's going on in front of them is a disgrace, and that needs to be clamped down upon. So. If it's not Bowes and Rovers, that doesn't happen.
Around other games, there will be instances, certainly. Okay. It's not exclusively a Bowes Rovers.
No.
Far from it.
No, I mean, that, you know, stuff can happen around grounds. Like, I feel like it's one of these ones, if you start naming examples, people get offended you name examples.
But there's been instances where
buses have had issues going to certain grounds and that type of thing. But again, you see... the reason I'm making the point about you don't even know if we're at the game, because naturally, yeah, you hope that like that clubs spot people that are clearly identified in these videos and ban them.
And are the clubs that sophisticated when it stops getting people in?
I think, you know, the point is that like they can meet away from, like, you can't ban them from society. Like you can't ban them from being within a 10-mile radius of the ground. I'm just saying that if they were banned, stuff will happen around the game. So, like, I mean, we end up going into terms like, well, it's about education, it's about this. I don't know actually how you clamp down on it. Like, the rivalry is one that exists. Now, I talk about deplorable, like in recent years, you would have had the odd sort of, and this definitely does happen because I've heard it and heard the accents, you would have like fans coming in from England for the Bowes Rovers game. Right. There's alliances with certain clubs. I think was it Bury in one instance, was there one or two like, that actually come in for the game? And
some Wrexham fans.
Wrexham is the one actually that I think I'm thinking of, you know, who come in for the match, you know, and I mean... like that, I think for people who don't go, it's definitely, you know, it just paints an image that's very unappealing. Well, I would go back to like in, for example, in Tallaght Stadium now, and I'm tempting fate here, when Shamrock Rovers played Bowes in Tallaght Stadium, it's a modern stadium, it's well laid out, and I can't recall any real instances of trouble around there. I mean, there has been the odd issue around Tallaght. But again, you know, the Bowes fans get Lewis out. I think if you have modern facilities and stadia, you can manage things. There's complications with Daily Mount that just, it's in the middle of a very busy area as well.
And you're on the edge of town, whereas Bowes fans, to give people an idea, if you're travelling out to Tallaght for an away game, you get the Lewis out there and essentially you're ferried, sorry, I have to speak into the microphone, you're ferried by the guards, more or less, to and from the Lewis stop.
That was the main thing they were doing.
You're just ferried to and from the Lewis stop up and down to the ground.
Okay.
And there's usually, like, there's a few catcalls and stuff like that from people who are in the flats and apartments up near us, but there's nothing major. But again, as Dan says, it's a question of facilities. It's a very hard thing to police in and around the area of Fisborough. Mm-hmm. Whereas Tallaght, just given the way it's laid out and given the way they have to actually take a bit of a schlep out there, it's better managed.
It's a delicate one, because you watch, there's Copa 90, there's this company that made a video a couple of years back on the Bowes Rovers derby, and as I said, the passion and the atmosphere that can be generated by the game, it makes it one of the best experiences, you know, to go to around Irish sport. But there's always a line that it can spill across to go to something completely different that, like, is used to fuel, you know, very negative stereotypes, you know, and there can be a hysterical tone to that sometimes. But I mean, that footage you saw is real. Yeah. You know what I mean? That happened. And for someone sitting in traffic, it's very real to them. They're not necessarily putting everything in context of the broader picture. They just go, well, I associate everyone that goes to this game with that. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem.
Okay. Joe, how dare you? There are no bad Danny Dyer films. I stand corrected.
Can you name three Danny Dyer films?
Oh, what's the one where he's in the West Ham firm?
That's Green Street.
Green Street, yeah.
5 stars.
Yeah. Name one that isn't football related.
It's a challenge, isn't it? When I ask the question, I don't know the answer. But I want the Joe to know, obviously.
Yeah. The next text is too tempting to pass by. Hi guys, did any of you see Kevin Coban in a very nice white pick knit polo neck today? That surely will put a smile on people's faces, says Tony.
Oh my God.
Well, I think we all smiled, Tony.
Absolutely, we did.
It reminded me of the video for Last Christmas.
I can't wait for the Christmas album.
It's a parody of Last Christmas. I saw Jimmy Bullard replied under Instagram saying, oh, killer. It's like, leave it out. And about 10 laughing faces. Jimmy Bullard.
Yeah. I want to hear more of your Jimmy Bullard impression.
Well, that's all you're getting.
Jimmy Bullard and Danny Dyer sort of merging into one.
It was out, so it's in Hello magazine today.
It's in Hello. Yeah, it's online anyway if you go looking for it.
Have you been through the photos?
Oh, yeah. They're wonderful.
It's like, is it like a Christmas Wonderland vibe?
No, it's a winter wonderland. Yeah, they're
sledding. Well, it does snow in Canada a lot. Like, it's not a set.
Is he definitely in Canada and not a set?
Yeah, it looked like actual snow and an actual polo neck. Right, so, yeah.
Listen, good on him. Good on him. So, let's start. Very sad news. The passing of Harry Gregg will be marked this evening in Stamford Bridge.
Yeah, both Chelsea and Manchester United wearing black armbands tonight in tribute to United goalkeeper Harry Gregg, who has died at the age of 87. The Northern Ireland legend passed away and was often referred to as the hero of Munich after helping pull survivors from the wreckage of the 1958 air disaster. Gregg was named goalkeeper of the tournament at the 1958 World Cup for his performances for Northern Ireland. While former United boss Alex Ferguson says he's deeply saddened by Gregg's passing, his former teammate Bobby Charlton says Gregg deserves to be remembered as one of the greatest names in Manchester United's history. Speaking to Usheen Langan in 2008, Gregg was keen to see the others who perished in Munich be remembered.
Everyone wants to talk about my teammates, about the team I played in, but there were a lot more people on board that aircraft. There was 9 great journalists, 8 of them were killed. There was a Yugoslav diplomat. There was a supporter called Willy Satinov who paid his own, the only to go there, and he lost his life. Those people have got to be remembered as well. My teammates were wonderful friends, but in my head I always think the journalists and the other people, their children must have said each time there was a celebration of the Busby Babes, what about my dad? Those things are terribly important to me.
You should note that interview with Harry Gregg has just been re-uploaded as a podcast on offtheball.com. Very well worth listening back to, recorded back in 2008.
Really interesting guy, you know, a lot of his interviews on Munich were generally fascinating because he came at it from a different angle. I think actually he would have been quite critical of Manchester United as a club as well. He felt that they didn't do enough in the years after, and I think he had this line about, you know, he'd listened to other people. I don't know who he was aiming his barbs at, but other people speaking about Munich as though they were there. And he was sort of, you know, he didn't just sort of go along with the flow. in terms of, you know, have you spoke about it? He had a very, I mean, he went back in saving people and you know, yeah. he'd lived through it, but always managed to, I don't know, just come out with a real thoughtful sort of way. And like, it's just, this is sad, you know, like all these great memories, and I don't know how many survivors there is of that team now, you know, there's obviously, you know, Bobby Charlton and a couple of others, but yeah, I thoroughly recommend anyone to sort of listen to that old interview or seek out any of stuff from his back catalogue, because yeah, he had a lot of interesting stuff to say.
Team news is in from Stamford Bridge.
Yeah, United seeking a first Premier League win in four games tonight. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's side have also failed to score in their last three league outings. New signing Odion Ighalo is on the bench tonight. United line out with David De Gea in goal. What's now become an almost customary back five of Aaron Wan-Bissaka, Eric Bailly, Harry Maguire, Luke Shaw and Brandon Williams. Fred, Nemanja Matic and Bruno Fernandes are in midfield with Daniel James in support of Anthony Martial. For Chelsea, Willy Caballero continues in goal at the expense of Kepa Arrizabalaga. It's a back four of Reece James, Andreas Christensen, Antonio Rudiger and Cesar Azpilicueta. In midfield, the trio of N'Golo Kante, Jorginho and Mateo Kovacic, with Willian and Pedro in support of Michy Batshuayi. Kickoff is at 8 o'clock.
Thoughts on this one, Dan?
Yeah, look, it's sort of it's a great opportunity for Chelsea, I think, you know, just to really cement their status. I think it's hard to be optimistic that Manchester United will do anything. Yeah. You know, it is one of these fixtures that, I mean, it's a real sort of cliche, sort of six-pointer, but it can, you know, it can be a real momentum swinger for whatever way things pan out. Although, obviously, the whole Man City situation and whether fifth place is a Champions League spot, whatever it might be, it's something we're going to have to analyse in time.
Yeah.
But in the here and now, while it is four places, it's a significant match, but for Chelsea, it's a great chance.
On Sky Sports News all day, the way they've advertised this game is that it's Keane and Carragher reunited.
Mm.
Which I have to say I thought was good.
They've been building this game up like it's the top two meetings. They've been at Old Trafford and Sky Sports News since 4 o'clock.
They've gone big on it, yeah.
Interviewing like Graham Lassow and Lee Dixon, who'd be doing the commentary for the US for NBC. Gus Poyet's been interviewed. Martin Tyler was interviewed as early as 4:30. I'm going... there seems to be a lot more on this game than I thought there was.
Or is that just an illusion, though? This is the thing. Like some of these big games that we've had in recent weeks, because the title is just over, like Arsenal, Manchester United, just these games that they're great games on paper, but if you're advertising your pundits as the main story, that probably says it all,
yeah,
doesn't it, about the actual match?
It does, yeah. It's on Sky. I think that's the main attraction of this game.
Is it?
I thought I would have thought. So Pep Guardiola, I think we were interested to see what he was going to say, and he's going nowhere.
It's understood Guardiola has told his players he won't be leaving because of their two-year European ban. The club are appealing against the punishment which was handed down by UEFA on Friday for breaching their financial fair play rules. Guardiola's contract, you might remember, runs until the end of next season. It's believed Guardiola told the City players, whatever league we are in, I will still be here. Even if they put us in League Two, I will still be here. This is a time for sticking together. Perhaps more key, City CEO Ferran Soriano told the players, trust me like I trust you, this will be dropped.
Yeah, I'm not so sure. We'll talk to Rob Harris on the football show about all this. There is the legal side, which is complex and tricky, and Rob will talk us through some of the minutiae there. We'll do that after 9 o'clock. And then I think maybe more fascinating to us is what's going to happen to Man City. So will Pep stay when they maybe are in a division lower or not in the Champions League? And yesterday, the papers were pretty unanimous, actually, that the three big flight risks in the short term are Raheem Sterling, certainly, who Man City want to sign a 450 grand a week contract, but that is now on hold. And then De Bruyne, who's 29 years of age and probably will find it trickier than a 25-year-old Sterling to spend 2 years out of the Champions League. He's on a 300 grand a year contract.
There's certain bonuses, I think, attached to his contract that suggest that he needs Champions League football. Okay. If he doesn't, he's off. Yeah.
And Laporte as well. Laporte was the other one. 300 grand a week, Laporte's set to earn. So they seem to be the three immediate flight risks. And then there's Guardiola. I mean, this business of, I'm staying no matter what, it does have the feel of a holiday romance that you say, we're going to stay together no matter what. And then reality starts to set in.
Pep told the City players, whatever league we're in, I will still be here. And they're listening. The players there listening, well, we won't be. Like, whatever. That's grand. But just to let you know, Pep, we won't be here in League Two. Yeah, what else are you going to say? Like, they're in the middle of a season, so no one is going to come out and say, well, I'll be off because of this, you know.
Good luck,
like,
lads.
So, in light of the news, I'd just like to confirm, I'm done. But if the season's market. Done, I am out of here. So, they're going to say this. I wouldn't read much into it. Like, even, like, you know, wasn't Sterling's agent, I think, suggesting he was going to go nowhere and whatever. They're clearly, I mean, there does seem to be this confidence from the club that they're going to get off in some shape or form. But it does seem like, and I know you're probably going to talk about this later on, it's not going to go across it, but like their case does seem to be, from what I can gather, well, you know, the problem was with the process and how it was handled, rather than actually fighting the fact that they weren't in breach of the rules.
The attack to CAS apparently is to say that the independence of the adjudicatory committee or whatever that's involved in UEFA, they're not as independent as they should be. And by that rationale, Tariq Panja, I think, was pointing out on Twitter earlier on, almost every similar punishment can be contested if this is overturned by CAS, because if you've got an IOC disciplinary committee who are funded by the IOC but independent of the IOC, you can say, ah, well, look, you're sure in payment of the IOC, we shouldn't have this ban enforced by you, or similar to the FA, or similar to the Federation of International Hockey, or whoever it might be, that this could throw any number of sporting decisions into tumult, because City say that maybe they've broken the rules, but the way they've found the way there isn't necessarily on the level.
That's the amazing thing. They haven't really ever come out and denied what Der Spiegel put in the paper last November. So one of the most damning aspects of the accusations against Man City is, for instance, there was a £65 million deal with Etihad and emails obtained through hacking and then put in Der Spiegel. Email suggested of that 65 million, Etihad, the sponsors, only gave 8 million and Sheikh Mansour picked up the tab for the rest. He was like, I'll pay the other 57 million. Completely against the rules. You can't bankroll the losses. So they've never actually come out and said, oh, that didn't happen. I don't think Sheikh Mansour has come out in any great way and said that didn't happen. As you said, Richie, Man City's defence thus far seems to be, yeah, you got us, but we don't like how you got us. So we can't let this stand.
Yeah, that does seem to be the base of it. But and we're always used to, in football, I think, to the initial harsh punishment. Actually, in other sports as well, you have the initial harsh sanction and then naturally it's rolled back on.
You're Saracens. You know, Saracens well, has been the interesting
maybe,
one.
Well, this is, yeah, there's a theme there that maybe, you know, maybe this is going to be applied now. But I just think the questions it raises, because, like, whatever, but you have the other clubs, right, as well, the other Premier League clubs, who actually, when it suits them, have gone in and been Man City's ally. Like, the big six have clubbed together to get certain deals for themselves, and, you know, they can't really adopt sort of a moral high ground stance, because they're in with City on a lot of stuff, you know, in terms of breaking how the Premier League is structured and the equal distribution of wealth and so on. They're very much in the same bed as Man City. So what happens if City suddenly get a very, like, this is upheld, and then City start making noises then about, well, I mean, breakaways and you know, breaking away from the Champions League and whatever, and who comes with them then? Yeah. You know, where do other clubs go? So I think whatever happens, I think this is going to be a significant moment, because it's in terms of tensions, there's almost like battle lines being drawn, and UEFA probably have to stand over what they do. But UEFA, I always feel, are always very caged. They're always cautious about offending the super clubs, because they still hold a certain amount of power.
Sure.
So it's there's layers to this one, and we'll be talking about plenty more again, I'm sure.
Andy Farrell then?
Yeah, he's named a 36-man squad for Sunday's Six Nations meeting with England at Twickenham. No Gary Ringrose, of course. He's still recovering from a broken finger sustained in the opening round win over Scotland. His Leinster teammate, Will Connors, is retained, as is the other uncapped player in the squad, Tom O'Toole of Ulster. Farrell will name his side for the England test on Wednesday. Bevan Parsons, meanwhile, has been omitted for the remainder of Ireland's Women's Six Nations campaign. The winger scored tries in both the wins over Scotland and Wales, but she's taking time out to concentrate on her leaving cert. Katie Fitzhenry returns from Sevens duty to take Parsons' place in the squad.
Best non-footy Danny Dyer movie is Severance. Cracking movie, and I'm not a Danny Dyer fan, says Dave in Galway, shocking me.
I imagine a lot of these are going to be straight to DVD.
Severance, never even heard of it.
Yeah, nor have I.
I was looking through his...
You're looking at his IMDb page during the middle of the show, Joe.
Yeah.
It's not great, is it?
No, I thought it would be better, because he's such a high-profile actor.
Because he's made a lot of crap.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
And he's done Danny Dyer's Deadliest Men, which is great entertainment.
Yeah. Gigi Buffon, says Terry, famously stayed with Juve when they were relegated. Look at where they are now.
A lot of that squad did. Del Piero did as well.
Flowing blonde locks...
Nedved
stayed as well.
Trezeguet did as well.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, City can still pay them loads of money as well. So, I mean, there are ways in which players will stay, but I think the point with someone like De Bruyne, who's 29.
2 years, costly. They're going to get, this will be settled at a year, won't it?
I have a feeling that it might be something like that. Yeah.
A year is an easier sell to certainly a Sterling. Rory McIlroy then?
Yes, he had to settle for a share of fifth place in his first tournament since returning to the top of golf's world rankings. A 2-over par final round meant he slipped out of contention and ended up 3 shots behind the eventual winner, Adam Scott. The Australian finished 2 strokes clear of the rest of the field.
Did you watch any of this?
I didn't actually know.
This was brilliant last night.
Really? Yeah, it sounded like it was top class.
It was really good. Riviera has never been as firm or as fast, so around the greens was causing players a nightmare. And it's interesting, Scott went on to win it. McIlroy and Scott, about 5 holes in, 6 holes in, just went too long of a green, and both had to chip on. It was like an upturned saucer green, and they both didn't get onto the green. The ball rolled back to their feet. That was where they both made a lot of trouble. Then they both eventually chipped on. McIlroy put it to within 2 feet 11 inches, and then missed the putt from 2 feet 11 inches, and then tapped in for a 7. Triple bogey.
Right.
And then bogey the next hole. And he was always in trouble from there. Whereas Adam Scott didn't 3-putt when he got onto the green, didn't bogey the next hole, and kicked on and won the tournament. So it was, but like, it was
a lot of worrying last round. Because I obviously have Rory in the mind from reading part 3 of his public image piece yesterday. And he actually spoke a lot, didn't he, about last rounds, various last rounds, going head to head with Brooks Koepka. And then even he referenced a previous one with Adam Scott in 2013, which actually brought momentum into 2014. So it's clear even some of these fringe events, he takes something from the head-to-head or the aspect of it, and I'm wondering, is it just easing his way into the season?
No, he was angry with himself. Mm. Like at one stage, he gave the pin a smack walking off the green, which is unusual for him.
Right.
Yeah. He usually wouldn't be that type. He might shake his head a bit, look at his caddy Harry and almost go look at the line again and say, oh, that didn't make sense. But he was just angry at a certain stage. Because I think he felt like he should have won that tournament. You know, he was the best player in the field. He's back to world number one. Matt Kuchar was around him. Adam Scott hasn't played since December. McIlroy absolutely looked like the favourite.
Should be more ruthless, basically. That's what you're saying. Or more clinical, I guess, you know, in that
position.
Probably,
yeah. Yeah, like realistically, yeah. By the standards he set himself, you know. And it was interesting, even a couple of weeks ago, Ronan O'Gara made the point when he was talking about kicking. Because he was saying how against Northampton, when he was very young, he missed penalties under pressure in a final. And he made a really great point, which is, and probably applies to McIlroy as well, you can brush that under the carpet because pressure only comes on a handful of times over a season. And McIlroy can still win lots of events. But when the pressure is really on, he has to find a way to find his best golf.
No, it's going to be an interesting year, I think.
You know? I still think he will win a major this year.
Yeah,
there is an intensity about him which was not there, certainly for... It's been here about six to 12 months or so, but previously it wasn't quite there. So he looks like a guy that has winning in his mind. Like Augusta can't come quickly enough.
And all the questions that come with it.
Well, yeah, I'm sure he's going to enjoy that part. Last story or two, Rich?
Bad news for Ulster. This evening, fullback Matt Faddies has been ruled out for the rest of the season. He requires surgery after sustaining a shoulder injury at the weekend. Faddies started and scored Ulster's second try in Saturday's 26-24 loss away to the Ospreys in the Pro 14. And Cork defender Kevin Crowley has suffered a fractured shoulder and he'll miss the rest of their Allianz Football League campaign. He was forced off late in their victory over Down in round 3.
Off the ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108. That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.